This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and we're talking about the future of drones today. We just heard about some of the commercial applications and the ways in which the state of North Carolina is paving the way for more drone flights in this state. Author and military expert William Arkin examines the impact of drones on military and warfare. His new book is called Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. And William Arkin joins us now. Welcome, William. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Jay Price is still with us, WNC's military reporter. So, William Arkin, tell us about it. I mean, Jay has, of course, given us an example of his time in Afghanistan, seeing these things at work, drones. How does the military view these things generally, drone technology? Where does the military, if there is a the military, see drone technology fitting in?
Well, it certainly has expanded enormously since the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now wars all over the Middle East and the Horn of Africa and beyond. When I first started doing work on drones, even just for this book, it was almost impossible to find an affordable commercial hobbyist drone to operate that could simulate all of the conditions of what the military might want to do. And the industry was just beginning. And the growth within the military itself was just beginning. So we think of military drones generally as the big predator Reaper-type drones. They're the size of a Cessna airplane, and they shoot missiles, and they're involved in the targeted killing program. But of the 14,000 drones that the U.S. military owns today, only about 500 of those are of that size. Most of the drones, as are most of the drones, say, even in North Carolina, owned by the military at Fort Bragg or Lejeune, are small Ravens and Shadows, and then there's special operations drones, that Wasps, Pumas, Mavericks, that are more silent or more stealthy or have special sensors aboard them. But I think the point that Jay made, that the drone itself is not an extraordinary piece of machinery anymore. It's a given that we can fly, and it's a given that these can be affordably and efficiently operated. The question, I guess, as the military is facing, is this exact same question that North Carolina faces, which is, what do you do with all the data that you're collecting? What portion of our economy does it actually enhance? Whose interests are behind the development of a drone industry? And for North Carolinians to think about this question, you know, I guess I would only stress that the commercial development of drones will follow very precisely where the money is. And where the money is in American society is national security and homeland security and law enforcement and first responders. That's where the real money is. And so that's where the drone predominance will occur. And though small companies might tout the agricultural use of drones, and there are certainly other areas, real estate, journalism, law, delivery, insurance, et cetera. The fact of the matter is that someone's going to have to pay for that. That's not the government. And I guess they're going to go begging for money, whereas the growth of drones in law enforcement, the growth of drones in support of firefighting, the growth of drones in terms of intelligence collection, even at the state level, is going to dwarf the commercial applications of those drones in a non-military sense for a long time in front of us.
Yeah, but you did talk about the amount of data and what to do with it. Give us the scope of this, of the amount of data that's collected almost every day, and yeah, what to do with it, particularly if you have rules about, you know, sort of how long you're going to hang on to intelligence data before you get rid of it. I mean, it's that kind of question. Give us the scope. How much is being collected right now?
Well, you know, I had my own personal experience with this when I started working on this book. I had this brilliant idea that I told my publisher, well, I'm going to buy a drone and I'm going to fly it and I'm going to then try to understand the aesthetic behind what is the fascination of the military with this. And similarly to Jay, I spent time with the military itself to see how they dealt with the drone question. And the funny part was that I learned that I was essentially facing the same problems that the military faced, and the military is essentially facing the same problems that all of us in civilian society face. Too much information, and what to do with that information. But there were other questions that I faced as well. Jay brings up the legal question, and I live in the state of Vermont, and I called a lawyer up and I said, okay, I've got my drone now and I'm flying it. And he said, well, you know, we have something called tort law. And tort law says if you look into your neighbor's yard, it's not an invasion of their privacy. But if you get on a ladder to look into your neighbor's yard, it's an invasion of their privacy. And though Vermont, like North Carolina, is just struggling right now in its legislature to figure out what the rules will be for the use of commercial drones, the fact of the matter is that there are basic privacy laws that apply. So we have a question of we have to fly them, which means that somebody has to man them. We have to do something in terms of the maintenance of these drones. We have to provide them with power and communications. We have to have a legal regime that covers them. And then finally, as all drones collect data, because that's what drones do right now in our society, we have to figure out what we're collecting and what we're going to do with it once we collect it. And then once we've collected it, how we're going to recover the information as the day goes by. So give me an example. In the military today, they are collecting 8 seasons worth of NFL games every day. That's how much video the military and the intelligence communities are collecting via drones today.
I'm just wondering if drones have the ability to detect the actual inflation rate, the air pressure on a football. Because well, that would be great. If they could do that, I think that they could reapply themselves and we'd have a much
better... Well, we'll see drones being utilized in sports very quickly because people want to see games from different angles. So I imagine we'll see NFL teams and baseball teams employing drones as part of the camera setup of a game. But you know, you ask an interesting question, and it's not preposterous. Drones don't just carry cameras. Some drones carry hyperspectral imagers, and those are capable of looking at objects at the molecular level to tell the difference between a football and a basketball based upon, say, for instance, the inflation. And let me give you an example of how that's actually played out. We have drones that have been utilized in Afghanistan that are able to detect carbon dioxide. And as a result of that, they can look at cave areas and detect areas where humans are present by the presence of carbon dioxide inside the caves. Mm. And so there are various types of sensors and various types of processes that are in place now, but it's a gigantic data machine. And that data machine is beginning itself to exert tremendous influence over how our military is shaped and how our military strategy is shaped, almost to the point of where we're really capable, highly capable, after 15 years of experience of killing an individual, of finding and killing an individual. But at the same time, we sort of don't have a strategy necessarily beyond the immediacy of today. And so I would argue that in some ways on the military side, drones make us dumber.
Well,
in the sense that they really force us to focus on the immediate and not look at the long term.
I want to pursue that line in a second, the strategic implications, but I don't want to get too far away from something else you said, which is the local implications and how this might be used in municipalities, Jay Price, in terms of not only police work but other municipal functions. I mean, the fact is they're cheap enough now for every city in the state to get one. How do you perceive these being used going forward? And what about the police and their use of drones in North Carolina, for instance?
Well, it's a brave new world. And as he was just saying, there are these really, really unbelievable sensors that can be mounted on the aircraft. And then at the other end of the scale, one of the issues is how cheap they are and how, with just a junky camera, this, kind of like last year's model. I talked to one town manager in Mooresville, and they had bought one a couple of years back for $1,000. And he said, the camera's good, but not great. They were using it to just snap photos of a golf course under construction to keep people who were worried about, the ninth hole or whatever, up to speed on when it would be open. He said, we probably will use it for public safety, but public safety includes fire department. You could put it over a fire or close by, give people a bird's eye view. But, you know, this whole new, this brave new world of equipment and technology means a whole brave new world of laws. And I talked to the ACLU of North Carolina. I talked to the policy director there, and she, you know, pointed out several loopholes in North Carolina's drone laws. And it's not only her, but the folks in DOT will tell you they think that the drone law and existing laws that apply to drones are going to have to evolve in unseen ways because there are kind of unforeseen uses of these things coming.
Well, we talk about unforeseen uses, and William Arkin, you talked about the strategic implications in the military. So both in terms of surveillance and what it might any implications it might have for domestic surveillance, but on the strategic side, if we're talking about military warfare, what are the ways in which, you know, the strategy, because you recount in your book a reluctance on the part of military commanders early on even to embrace drones. So the idea that the full implications, strategic implications, haven't quite been written out doesn't seem far-fetched given the reluctance initially to even accept the technology, right?
Well, I think two important things collided after 9/11. One was a conviction on the part of the American public that there were going to be boots on the ground, that there were going to be people involved in an operation, that whatever the fight against al-Qaeda was going to be was going to involve human beings and not be cruise missiles and drone-fired missiles, which somehow people characterized with the weaknesses of the previous years. So that happened, and then at the same time, of course, the technologies were just maturing. If you think back to 2001 and you think about your own cell phone, you know that you didn't yet have a smartphone that was really smart, and now you have a really smart phone. Well, think of drones in the same way. There were rudimentary drones, but now we have really smart drones. And so in this 15-year period, as things have developed, those collisions have continued. That is, the military's own honor and doctrine and history and its own narrative, its aesthetic about the role that people play, which certainly people in North Carolina can understand quite clearly, is important, and the technological advances that are being made that are increasingly supplanting the roles that people play, and in a way that I think is different than the debate of yesterday where we said, okay, we're spying with satellites and we need to have real secret agents on the ground. That debate is over. The amount of data that's being collected is so enormous now that the major challenge is just how to deal with all the information that's being collected, manned or unmanned. And then I think there's a third factor, and it also will influence what happens in North Carolina. And that is that the military discovered at the same time that a new generation of young people were coming into the military, what we call digital natives or millennials. And these are people who have a very different aesthetic, both about the world and about technology. So what characterizes these digital natives? Well, first, they don't like to read, they like to do. And so training in the military has really evolved in a different direction. There's a lot more hands-on training and a lot less classroom training, especially when it relates to intelligence and drones. Second, these are people who like to collaborate. And so there isn't a drone operation that takes place in the military or in the intelligence world that doesn't involve multiple chat windows open at the same time on a desktop and all sorts of communications among widely dispersed people, where the operator of the drone might be in Nevada and the person looking at the video might be in Connecticut, and the person directing the mission might be forward in Afghanistan. And then third, it's immediate. It really mirrors the internet, it mirrors our society today. And the truth of the matter is that just keeping up with the actionable intelligence, as they call it, the immediate impact of the collection of this information really does require so much resource and so much energy that we have sort of lost sight of. the larger and broader questions of strategy.
But how
and
does so that? Well, let me stop you there, because you said this. This is the second time you've made reference to this. Earlier, you said it makes essentially the military dumber because it focuses us on the immediate without taking the big picture. But I mean, drones do. They don't just collect data. They can actually deliver ordnance. They can blow things up and kill people. And it seems to me that you could develop a strategy around warfare that might be different than when you had to actually employ whole units and feed those units and risk their loss. That kind of thinking should be able to go on while you're still tracking an insurgent making his or her way through the rubble of some town in Afghanistan. Why can't you do both?
Well, I think right now, with the end of major combat in Afghanistan and Iraq, or at least the ratcheting down of the level of that, that thinking is beginning. But we're far away from a military strategy that incorporates what society will feel will be a proper mix, a proper balance between manned and unmanned. And also, we're quite far away from any kind of a consensus as to how autonomous all of this should be. You can't have thousands of drones up there doing the fighting with humans behind them unless you are willing to make that kind of an investment. And so then the question becomes, well, how autonomous do you make the drones? The drone, you know, has in its library of images exactly what X object looks like, and it's going to attack X object when it sees it. That's the autonomy that we're working on now, automatic target recognition. And we as a society are just going to have to make a decision as to whether or not that's what we want. Do we want a military that does that, or do we want always to know for sure that we have a human in the loop and that we have a humanity in the loop? And these questions are questions that are being addressed, but the last 15 years of fighting has been really a technological explosion in which we have not spent the time and energy to evaluate what the impact of drones might be on the future of warfare.
Jay Price, you've talked to certainly the commanders and the senior officers here on the bases, the various bases in North Carolina. What's your sense of how they perceive sort of how to move forward with drones? Is that just sort of one more tool in the arsenal? Yeah, we'll weave it in. Or do they have a feeling that we need to set a few meetings aside to figure out, you know, this is do you think military commanders see this as dramatically changing the nature of warfare in the future, or is it just another tool, another blip in the technological scale?
Oh, I'm sure at the top that they understand that it's changing the nature of warfare. You know, down in on the front lines, they're just more interested in getting, you know, for example, getting a small one over the hill so they can see what's over the hill, and they don't have to go send somebody up there to look and see what's over the hill. Potential lifesaver.
Well, William Arkin, what do you think is the future? Is this something that sort of calls for its own meetings, or will it simply just be sort of incorporated in and move forward the way technology often does in the military?
Well, I think the answer is half that drones are like automobiles, that we're in the early stages of the development and growth of a large amount of unmanned vehicles within our society, land and air. And we're going to have to come up with the rules for the road, and we're going to have to come up with an understanding of what impact they're going to have. And that, you know, like cars, means everything from the highways to air pollution. And then secondly, I think you have to look at drones in their sort of non-technical sense. If we didn't have drones today, we'd probably have to invent them, which is to say that the drones are really not what is important, but the data that is collected by them is what is important. And we've certainly seen a data explosion in our own lives and in with smartphones, with the internet, with even the news. And people, normal people, struggle every day to figure out what to do with all the information that we're ingesting, how to collect it, how to categorize it, how to store it, and then how to recall it. And those are the same questions that the government is facing. So it seems to me we're in a unique position to actually have an influence over what we as a society want the impact of drones to be, but more important, what we want the impact of data to be.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. William Arkin, author of Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Jay Price, WNC's military reporter. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks, Frank.
Just ahead, we'll talk with award-winning author Jacqueline Woodson. Stay with us on The State of Things.